Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within one day. No juggling emails, no calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. That's ZipRecruiter.com/shock. One more time, try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/shock.
Welcome to episode 64 of Shockwaves. If we sound a little different, it's because we are within the halls of the Mystic Museum where Slashback Video has been erected.
Oh, yeah.
I am your co-host, Ryan Turek. Next to me is Mr. Elric Kane. Across from me is Rob Galuzzo and Rebecca McKendry. How are you? Welcome to Slashback Video.
Elric, how do you feel? Because you seem like the one that's mixed with the most mixed emotions right about now.
Well, I'm not. They're not mixed. This is pure joy. But it is. It just made me a little sad that it's not like this for everyone, like in video stores. It really reminds you that people don't get to experience this, which is crazy.
Well, that's fantastic.
That's how we grew up. Doing this.
This is exactly why I'm doing this. And also joining us is Eric Wessel of the Mystic Museum.
How you doing?
Eric, how are you?
Pretty good.
Eric is a man who, when I had this kind of wacky idea, our mutual friend Stephanie Jones, she's a co-owner of Mystic Museum, correct?
Yep.
And I had known Eric and Kiko, who also are the proprietors, just from going in and spending lots of money here. And I really dug their gallery space. They did some fantastic stuff, Twilight Zone, Hitchcock, David Lynch, and every time my girlfriend and I would come on opening night, it would just be a line around the block. It's insane. You guys do some really killer stuff here.
Thanks.
And it's just a unique shop on this monster strip that we call Magnolia Boulevard in Burbank, where you can also find Dark Delicacies and Creature Features and other shops.
The horror strip.
Yeah, Blast from the Past.
But anyways, they were awesome enough to join forces with me to do this kooky endeavor called Slashback Video, which is kind of like just a throwback to the video store days of the 80s.
Los Angeles listeners, you have one day from when this airs.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
That's right. We open tomorrow at...
At 8 to midnight.
8 to midnight.
But it's going to be here for a while.
It'll be here through October, and if it continues to go well, we'll keep it up longer. Wow. But definitely through Halloween, for sure.
Now, Eric, I just want to kind of get this out of the way. Tell me just a little bit about your history with the store, how it got started. What was the kind of impetus to get a shop like this going?
All right, I'll try to make it quick. So I owned a store, or I still own a store, called Beer Lady Vintage and Oddities with Kiko, my girlfriend.
Much of my house has been decorated from, I have to add.
Awesome.
So, yeah, like that is my shop of choice.
Cool. And so we've owned that store about 5 years, and then we had kind of an idea to have a museum space within that store. A lot of people came in and says our oddity shop and vintage store resembles a museum. And we're like, are we losing out on selling products? Because people just want to come and look. And when we're looking to expand Beard Lady Vintage and Oddities, we came across a building. And then our landlord in our current building says, I want to extend your lease. But we're like, we already have this other building in mind. And we're like, that's the idea. Mm. Let's do the museum. Let's do the Mystic Museum. And so that's where that started. And then we asked our friend Stephanie to be a partner with us. Three heads are better than two. And, you know, we quickly opened that up. I think it took about less than 2 months of working all the time to open it up. And then recently, just now, we doubled the size of the museum and have moved the oddity shop next to the museum. So this actual exhibit that you're going to see is going to be double in size. So it'll fit a lot more people. The lines will still be a lot of people, but shorter, so you don't have to wait in line as long. There's going to be two registers to ring up on, so those lines will be shorter. And it's going to be a lot more fun because it's actually two large shows combined into one night.
Yeah, can you explain what the other show is?
Yeah, so with Slashback Video, we do another show, which is Ben Cooper Company, who has done all the masks from the 1930s through about the 80s. I think sold the company in the 90s. Yeah. But they're having a resurgence. They're coming back. And they wanted to have an exhibit of their stuff, and we're like, being the fact that we are vintage Halloween collectors and things like that, and I own like three of their devil masks already, I was like, yes, let's do that. Yeah. And it was actually within the same week that Ryan asked me to do Slashback with him, and I was like, this is perfect combination, Halloween versus horror. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be two large shows going on at once.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're staring across from a lot of the masks now, and it's spectacular. I mean,
this is clear boxes. Yeah, with
this is
going to
kick off
masks.
Halloween yeah. just right.
I just yeah. walked through, and two of the masks from my childhood are in there. There's the strawberry shortcake one I wore when I was probably four, and then the She-Ra Princess of Power one I wore when I was maybe nine. So it's like the whole thing. Like it followed me yeah. through my childhood, right. And they're both in there, and I'm yeah. like, it's so amazing to yeah. see them.
I'm pretty sure I had the R2-D2 one. It was the hangar version they had at Kmart.
Yeah. So. Wow. The one that took me off guard is the Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. They did an Attack of the Killer Tomatoes
costume
mask.
Over there? Oh,
yeah, we actually...
Take a look at that.
Part of the exhibit is the actually start-to-finish process of a costume, and it happens to be on display the Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, which I thought was a great segue into Slashback Video.
Yeah.
When I was... I Q&A'd the Ben Cooper panel at Midsummer Scream a couple of weeks ago, and one of the questions that I asked on the panel was, what were some of the like weirdest costumes that they ever had? They had a Rubik's Cube costume. There was a whole bunch of yep. weird ones like that in the 80s where they were like, well, this game seems to be big. Can we make a battleship costume? I don't know if there was a battleship one, but there was definitely a Rubik's Cube one because I was trying to picture what that would exactly look
yeah,
like.
Yeah. I just have to tell the listeners that Becca is strategically placed in front of a VHS of The Boneyard.
Yes.
And it's so funny because
damn straight
that
I
was
am.
A movie I didn't even know what it was until a couple weeks ago on our show. Yeah. And the fact that she is sitting right behind this.
Right. And we actually have
awesome.
We actually have two copies of The Boneyard. We have the one with so the funny. Yellow yellow cover and then the older.
The one with Phyllis Diller on
the
it.
The one with Phyllis Diller.
Yeah.
We really can't just paint a picture with our words here. This yeah. is pretty
well,
special.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think, you know, Eric and I have been working closely, bouncing ideas off each other. And, you know, one of the things that I sent an email to you today about the DJ set list.
Yes.
And I was just like, yeah. it's got to be like 80s heavy metal and, you know, The Man Behind the Mask and a lot of Alice Cooper and Return of the Dead. But then it's like, well, we should also throw in some vintage Halloween tunes for the Ben Cooper side of it.
Yeah. But I think a lot of them are one and the same, too, which is good.
Oh, totally.
You know, a lot of theme songs. And, and what I liked about starting this with you was the first couple meetings was more of like excitement and not work. It was like, we could do this, we could do that, we could do, oh my God, we could do this, what about this? It was like, and then talking to friends after that and then being like, well, I remember my video store had this. So taking everyone's ideas of or what their video store had and trying to put it all into this, so the nostalgia is there for everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Collectively, I think what you and I have both heard was, oh my God, I want to live here. Also, oh my God, it looked just like my video store back in Milwaukee, Michigan, New York, wherever they're from.
It actually looks better.
Because of the horror.
It's a little bit more horror.
Yeah.
But,
and they even have the adults only room, which did not lead to
an adults only room.
But it's okay. It's okay.
But we're also going to, Eric, you could speak a little bit to this. We're also inviting artists to do a gallery section. So what do we do?
Yeah, because we're known for being an exhibit and art shows in one, what we came up with is having the artist actually paint or make their artwork on clamshell cases. So some of the racks you walk by, you're like, I never heard of this movie before. That's because it's an original art piece that's done by, it's either a recreation piece that they did or they came up with something new, but they're all on the VHS racks like you would see in an old school store. And they're all right behind us over there. There's a whole whole wall.
It's like someone made a Critters.
Let's not forget the Rob Schraub originals.
Shark Hotel is over there, guys. Shark Hotel.
Yeah, then we have a new release section, which is, you know, I think a great touch because it's some of the stuff that has come out recently, but in the vein of a VHS.
Yeah, It Follows original VHS.
And Beyond the Gates.
So yeah, then. And then there's Camp Bloodbath, which is from the Final Girls. It's the movie within the movie, so somebody actually made a VHS copy
of that. That's cool.
But it's also a mixture of, like, Almost Human, Beyond the Gates, Tales of Halloween should be coming by Friday.
Oh, cool.
So we have, like, it represents both movies that have been released, contemporary movies that have been released on VHS, as well as just a few, like, oddball, never fake movies.
How many fake movies did Rob Schraub contribute?
Schraub contributed probably like 13.
I love one.
They're insane.
And now Annihilator Ballerina. Am I reading that right?
Oh, it's Ballerina Overdrive.
Ballerina Overdrive. And Elric, I don't know if you saw it, but there's also Halloween 3 Part 2.
Oh.
Airlines.
Schraub's a maniac, but also big shout out to our sponsors, Mixtape Massacre, Waxwork Records, Fright Rags, Creepy Company, Phantom Carriage Brewery. And also Bill Neal. Bill Neal, who is a famous trailer editor here in town. He's done all of the major horror movie titles.
He donated Pandemonium, which is not a good movie, but it's a fascinating movie that really everyone should watch.
Well, Bill was interesting because he heard about it and then he contacted me and he was like, Ryan, I just want to throw in. He was like, let me contribute some monetary funds and let me show you what my office looks like. Took a picture of his office and it was all these VHS tapes along with I don't want to give away too much, but there was all the goodies that he supplied us, and I was like, "Oh my God, you really love it." He goes, "Ryan, I will help you in any way," and he and I would like go back and forth on eBay searches, and he'd be like, "I'd be like, hey, Bill, I found this Children of the Corn 3 corn on a cob inflatable
cob."
Yeah.
That ridiculous.
The next email I got was, "I bought the cob."
Needed the cob.
What I like getting was the random Craigslist links. Here's an old VHS store, not VHS, but like just a regular DVD rental store. Went out of business. They have all this for sale, and I would just get random like Craigslist links. I was like, "Oh my God, that's awesome!" Yeah. We actually did get
you guys made a schlep to Long Beach for these racks.
The racks original VHS racks. Yeah. So, and actually, what I love about this is the VHSs that are here are original.
They're,
everything's real. Yeah.
And just a heads up, you cannot touch them, unfortunately, because these are all part of a private collection. They're all from multiple private collections. And I did make a promise that these are kind of a no touch policy, just because some of them are pretty expensive and some of them are in great shape. I mean, we literally have a sealed Warner Home Video Exorcist release.
Wow.
I mean, like, an initial run of The Exorcist.
But I have a feeling you're going to come here and see stuff that you're going to be wowed. Like, the covers, like, we're setting them up, and I'm just like, I can't stop, like, looking. I should be working, and I'm looking.
Or even just, like, take catalog of stuff that you haven't seen. Elric's walking around with his fucking notebook, writing down
it's
things
true.
He's never
like,
seen.
I need to do that, because as I was walking through, I was discovering things that I'd never seen before, and then it suddenly reminded me of the video store, where literally, like, you're walking past it, and your attention is drawn to it far more than when you're looking at, like, 500 things on your scroll on Netflix.
You know what would be cool would be, because you can't touch them, every Sunday should be called Flip Sunday, and you guys turn all of them around. So somebody has repeat reason to come back.
That's a good idea.
And they could literally see all the backs.
That's like, interesting. Yeah.
I would love to come back for that, because the back covers were really special. I remember spending a lot of time, and the photos were always misleading.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like that.
Absolutely.
I like that.
Like, I've never seen Dead Easy or Zoltan, Hound of Dracula. I saw Natas, The Reflection over there. Not a good movie, but I haven't seen it since I was a kid, and suddenly I was like, I should watch Natas
playing
again.
Playing on a TV.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a TV in the corner where we will be playing.
It was playing Nightmare 4 when we came in. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, I actually brought my VHS player from home that I actually had hooked up, because I watch VHS. And Kiko's like, why do you have that here? I was like, because I have like VHSs I want to watch. And she's like, why would you still watch VHSs? I was like, because I like the previews.
Coming attractions.
That Nightmare 4 VHS did have some good previews. But it's, you know, Eric and I are talking about the future of Slashback, and ideally, I think what I would love to have be done is that, you know, between us, a mass or a collection of our own that we yeah. can control, as opposed to it being part of a, you know, other owners, Devin Whitehead being one of them. And that way
we're sitting in front of the wall of Devin. Yeah.
But being able to, you know, give visitors a chance to be able to pick stuff.
Yeah.
Pick stuff up and be able to take
hopefully
a look
in the future that you'd be able to come in and yeah. almost like pick it up and look at the back and read it like you used to do when you were trying to figure out if you want to rent it or not.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. So in the theme of Slashback Video, and Eric, feel free to chime in if mm-hmm. you'd like, you know, we kind of picked a selection of titles, that are not available, anywhere else but on VHS. Some titles that you can't find on DVD or Blu-ray. Feel free to call us out in the comments if we're wrong, because there were a couple films that I was like, oh, Gargoyles from the 70s. I haven't seen that on DVD. No, it exists on DVD.
Yeah, I ran into that a couple of times where it was like they did a limited release or some tiny fly-by-night company released like 20 copies in 1999. Do we still call that a DVD release? And I did. If anyone had touched it, I didn't include it.
Yeah.
Well, I never know if Code Red put one of these.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I included Hide and Go Shriek on one of my original lists, which I just remember it was teens running around a furniture store.
That is out on Blu-ray.
And then I looked and I was like, oh, that's out. And then I ordered a copy.
See, I changed my mind as soon as I walked in here. I was walking in here with a list of ones I've talked about a bunch on here. And I just walked around going, no, I just want to talk about movies I haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
Like, though I have nothing to add except I want to see it, it's what
maybe
your mind
people
goes
can
to.
Give you reviews of the ones that you've never
like
seen.
Like, you're in front of Summer Camp Nightmare. I just want to watch
great
it right
one.
Now.
Dude, I love that one.
Dude, yeah. I'm getting there. List? It's okay. on my list. Right. It's like, it's right there.
On Becca's Santa Claus stationery.
I got kids.
That was something.
But before we dive into our picks, I just want to remind you that we are on social media. Shockwaves Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And don't forget to give this podcast a couple star ratings on iTunes. Don't forget to throw in reviews.
Five star, please.
Yeah, not a couple.
Well, I'm just, you know, in addition to the maybe, you know, whatever. And Eric, you want to weigh in as to where you can find Mystic Museum?
Yeah, you just got our main thing. You just look us up on Instagram, the Mystic Museum. Tickets are still available at the door for Slashback in the Ben Cooper Show.
Yep.
And then we also have an online store, which is linked on our Facebook and Instagram page, which is the Mystic Museum, and also Beard Lady Vintage on Instagram as well.
Sweet. Rob, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. I saw quite a couple of things. Number one, I'm going to mention, just because I literally came straight from it, and people may challenge me on the horror, but
you
I think
saw
it's
it
one
again.
Of... Nope.
You're wearing a shirt.
No, we will see it again the night that this airs.
Yeah, that's true.
All of us.
Nice.
No, I went to see Strangers on a Train at the New Beverly, and it's got one of my favorite cinematic psychos that I've ever seen.
He's my favorite. He's just so good.
He's so good. And what's cool is the New Beverly here. You know, it's funny. I own all the Hitchcock movies on Blu-ray for the most part, but I never watch them. I wait to see them on the big screen here because there is a little bit of magic to seeing them on the big screen and with an audience. And what's great is right now this month, starting today, the New Beverly are doing Wednesday matinees. So every Wednesday at 2, they're showing a Hitchcock movie.
And I heard it was packed.
And it was sold out.
There's a lot of actors in this town, unemployed.
Who are these? Yeah,
Ted Raimi was sitting on a row.
There you
so,
go.
It, like, yeah, like Ted Raimi just showed up on his own
That's
to check
awesome.
Out some Hitchcock.
Wow.
And that was what was cool about it. Phil Blankenship, who was hosting it, came up and said, hey, we've wanted to do this for a long time. Right. We just thought nobody would come, and you guys sold it out, so we're going to keep this going as long as we can.
And that one's a particularly good print, because I saw that as a double last year.
Oh, man, it was so much fun.
And it became it actually went from being one of those Hitchcocks I liked to actually, like, top couple. Like,
oh, yeah.
It has a sequence where he stalks a woman in the carnival.
Oh, well, that was one of the best sequences. And I believe a little snippet of that is in Terror in the Isles, if I'm not mistaken. They take a little bit from Stranger in a Train, which... Brief summary is just these two guys meet on a train. One is a famous tennis player. The other is questionably a psycho. And basically says, you know what would be great is the perfect way to get away with murder is if we switched. Like, I did a murder for you and you did one for me. And obviously the tennis player considers it kind of a joke until the other guy actually goes through with with his murder. And from there, it's just a lot of fun, a lot of suspense. And, I mean, the crowd was going nuts for, like, the last 20 minutes.
The tennis scene in it is amazing.
Yeah,
there's this
good.
One tennis scene. It's just epic.
Wow.
And they showed a tennis Tom and Jerry cartoon before.
Oh, nice.
Which
was
like,
nice.
That fits together.
Nice. Tom and Jerry have killed some people.
Yes, yeah. So Strangers on a Train, Hitchcock. It's always good to go back and watch a Hitchcock movie.
Yeah.
It's terrific.
So what about you guys?
Becca?
I'll jump in. So the first one I'm going to talk about is a book, and I brought it for you guys to look at. So when I was in Phoenix Comic Con earlier this year, I had talked about how everyone was like freaking out about My Favorite Thing is Monsters, and everyone was trying to get it, and like every vendor at Phoenix Comic Con sold out copies within the first 24 hours of the festival. Well, I finally got a copy and started reading it.
From the Burbank Library.
From the Burbank Library. So I procured a copy from the Burbank Library and have been reading it, and it is freaking unbelievable, guys. Like, I can't even call this a horror graphic novel. It's a masterpiece, really. Like, I can see why it was swooped up for movie rights before it was ever even released. So it is about a girl. She's 10 years old, living in one of the poorer neighborhoods of Chicago in the late 60s. And she lives in a rundown building with a whole bunch of eccentric characters. And she herself is obsessed with horror movies. Her whole family is. Like, they love monsters. They love monster magazines and things like that. And she gets kind of ridiculed by the teachers at her Catholic school and the other kids because of it. And so when she draws herself, she identifies herself as a monster. So she draws herself as a werewolf through the whole thing. But the actual story is not only... so it bounces back and forth between two main time periods. A woman in her building who is a Holocaust survivor is this like strikingly beautiful woman, but really kind of haunted mentally, dies. And everyone thinks that she's committed suicide, but this young girl is determined that it was murder. Mm. And so she embarks on this kind of detective journey to try to figure out who in the building could have murdered her.
That's cool.
But at the same time, you're seeing all this stuff that's going on in Chicago in the 1960s, like all of the different riots that were happening and Martin Luther King's assassination and all this stuff. It is epic, is the only way I can describe
it.
It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And I mean, just because it's a 10-year-old female protagonist who's obsessed with horror and feels ostracized from it, like, I just want to give the protagonist like a hug the whole time. And then to be able to use that kind of horror framework to tease out these bigger historical stories, because it does get into, as she's doing her detective work, it gets into the history of the Holocaust and what this woman probably went through and everything. And it gets really intense, but beautiful. So I can't recommend this one enough. My Favorite Thing is Monsters by Emile Ferris.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
I got a chance to take a look at To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story, the documentary.
I've been wanting to see that.
Derek Herbert directed. I think it made its debut at Frightfest, UK, I think. But it is an excellent documentary about a man who is a horror icon, has played Jason multiple times, and so many other, and has starred in so many other films as a stuntman, doing so many. I mean, like, I didn't know he was in House 2.
He did
a stunt in House 2. He's done stunts.
It's a Sean Cunningham connection.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, it gets into a little bit of the industry stuff, but what was especially touching is that it is, it really gets under the skin of Kane Hodder and what had happened to him, why he had gotten burned, how that had emotionally affected him, how that psychologically affected him. Mm. I mean, he really does lay it all out.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, growing up, you see these, you know, these tough guys in the pages of Fangoria and underneath the makeup, and you kind of paint a portrait of who they are, but you don't really know who they are. And so when you go to conventions, what do you get? You get 5 seconds of fleeting, you know, contact with them. They sign their autograph. Maybe he does the lip thing.
He strangles you.
He'll show you his lip tattoo. He strangles you, and then off you go, you know. And to see this man, this real tough guy, sitting there talking about how he was really, like, painfully bullied as a kid. And growing up as kind of a guy who would do crazy things to impress other people, to segueing into stunt, being a stuntman, to, you know, his story. I don't want to lay out the story, but I'm sure you read the book. It's in there as well. But, you know, and seeing him cry on camera and how what he had done post-burn, how it affected this little girl that he ran across. It's just like, oh, my God, you know? But it's also very uplifting in the sense that, you know, being a stuntman, being Jason Voorhees, and then doing all these other great films, you know, you're like, it's very uplifting. And for the first time ever, I actually was pretty pissed that he wasn't Jason in Freddy vs. Jason.
Yeah.
I have always been that guy that was like, yeah, he had his run. Great. He was, you know, let someone else be Jason.
Not me.
But when, when you hear it from Kane's mouth And then you hear it from Robert Englund's mouth, because Robert Englund is also interviewed, as is Cassandra Peterson and other people. You actually do feel that kind of frustration and that anger. And for the first time I ever felt, you know, I actually felt that. I was like, you know what? Fuck that, man. He should have been Jason in that. A really good doc. It's making the festival rounds, to Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story. Check it out.
Cool.
I've been dying to tell you guys the story all week, because this just happened a couple of days ago, and it very much ties into this now. So I'm at a film school. There's an acting department, and every day I see this older guy who, just for whatever reason, there's something about him that looked familiar. And every day I go to school. The last time I was working, he was in the same room with me. I ate lunch in the room with this guy for 40 minutes without saying a word, which is – and then I go home that day. And I realized something. I was like, oh, shit, I got to look him up. Maybe he's an actor I've seen. I look him up. He hasn't acted in anything I saw. Then I scroll down his credits. He produced one movie. The movie is Soul Survivor.
Oh, my God.
What is the chance
gosh.
That I, of all people who have been talking about a movie for the last 2 years.
No, the guy who came, I mean, like the fact that the guy from Things.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
But I'm saying you have that touch. Imagine. You have that touch.
So his name's Saul Romeo. He's the only guy who's interviewed on the Blu-ray. And I told him, you know, I was the one telling them to put it on Blu-ray on Pure Cinema. I was like telling Code Red Bill, like, you've got to put this out. Yeah. But the funny thing, I just asked him. So I go up to him. I was so excited. I'm like, oh, you did this movie. That meant a lot to me. And he just looked at me and goes, oh, yeah, we got fucked by the distributors. And that's all he said. Wow. He literally said they ripped him off and they got nothing at the time, and it was broken. But I was like, wow, like, of all the people in the world, I got to, like, so I'll probably never even ask.
So he teaches acting?
Yeah, he's like an expert at, like, Meisner or something, and that's what he's been doing for, like, the last 40 years. But it was just so weird that I recognized him. It's probably because I saw the DVD extras, like, 4 years ago or something.
Fans of Shockwaves, just gravitate to Elric Kane, and soon enough you'll probably run into some weird, obscure.
But not to give anything away, but there's a little bit of a tie-in to this place, and I was very impressed with that when I walked in. So thanks for that.
By the way, I saw that Blu-ray because
I just got it.
It's pretty cool. Code Red is doing a lot of these exclusive Blu-rays through Diabolik DVD.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the only place I can get Soul Survivor.
Only place on Blu-ray, And the same thing with Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker. Only Diabolik has the Blu-ray version of it through Code Red.
Oh, shit.
So they've been doing a handful of exclusive Blu-ray releases through them. But really quick on Soul Survivor, because I know you've talked about it a lot, but I just saw it for the first time.
Oh, you've never seen it?
I'd never seen it. I was waiting for this Blu-ray release, and it is really cool.
It's a real movie,
really
cool movie.
Really creepy moments in that.
It's definitely its Final Destination, and it follows
it's just
through
right there,
and through.
Man.
It's got that creepy vibe to it, which is basically a woman has a premonition of another woman surviving a plane crash. Yeah. So she's the only one that survives this thing. And then in the background, there's like people kind of in the background that are these sinister characters.
It's kind of like, death is kind of coming. Yeah.
It was really cool.
So I'm excited to rewatch it. I just got it as well. But anyway, just quickly. So very much in the vein of these kind of movies, I had never seen The Slayer.
I haven't seen
Arrow. I have never seen The Slayer.
I just got mine. Oh, Becca, I have a present for you. It's The Slayer in my bag.
Thank you.
No, I do. Sorry.
I will be watching The Slayer.
Maybe I should wait. Arrow Films, amazing cover, right?
Yeah.
This is the joy of VHS. This cover is amazing.
I saw a trailer play at CineFamily, and it blew my mind, and I was really dying to see it.
Okay. I watched Soul Survivor instead of this.
Okay.
So I make the right choice?
I just want to keep teeing up Elric to go.
We're not a hateful podcast. I got to say, like, we went. I'm so excited to watch this. On the cover, there's a monster. You will see exactly 3 seconds of that creature. I'm not exaggerating.
Let me add it to my remake.
Of this movie's running time, the horror part of this movie is probably about a minute 40 of the 90 minutes. It is really just people kind of walking around an island for 80-something minutes, and then like a couple punctuations, a lot of POV, but without any payoff. It's going to frustrate the fuck out of you. But when the horror couple seconds do come, they're really cool. And you really are just like, oh, it's their first film. The guys explained on the disc, like, oh, the first time where you didn't really know what we're doing. You're like,
And
all we kept, you'll appreciate that, all me and Dick kept saying afterwards is, oh, man, it's no Madhouse. Because it's also shot just across the water, Tybee Island. So Madhouse is shot in Savannah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also used to live near a place called Tybee Island, and that's where this one's entirely set.
Wow.
It's a bummer because the cover is so fucking rad.
It is cool.
But some people probably love this movie, so I don't want to hate on it. It was just kind of a bummer because you want just a little more.
Yeah.
But you know, it would fit in perfectly here.
Yeah, exactly. Have you checked out anything this week? I mean, you've been busting your ass getting this shit.
Yeah, so. I actually did check something out the other day, but I usually just get a chance to, you know, get home at like midnight to 2 a.m. The other day I put something on that was on Netflix, and Kiko suggested it, Little Evil.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to see that. The Netflix thing.
Yeah, yeah, and I was just like, I like things like The Burbs, Monster Squad, yeah, you know, Army of Darkness, things that are a little more fun, comedy-related horror. So I did enjoy it. It wasn't the best movie I saw, but I really enjoyed it, and it actually was relaxing to watch something lighthearted like that. Mm. And still had its really good moments, really funny moments, but...
Oh, was it a movie?
Yeah. It's a movie, yeah.
I thought it was a new series.
Yeah, no,
it's a made-for-Netflix
right?
movie. Yeah. Adam Scott, yeah. Eli Craig, the director of Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God, I love those guys.
It was really enjoyable, so...
It looks like it's basically like premises. What if Damien Thorne was?
Well, they do this whole thing where, like, I think the ongoing joke in it is that becoming a stepfather, your son or daughter is evil. And that's the ongoing thing, and then you know everything gets twisted around in the end, and it was pretty funny. Yeah, it's funny moments.
It looks like The Omen if it was a sitcom.
Yeah,
yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah. That looks really fun. Yeah.
That's funny. All right, I'll check it out this weekend sometime.
Nice.
Yeah, when you have the weekend.
Rob,
one that, again, all questionable horror in my picks this week, but I thought it was a horror movie. My friend Dave Parker got the Canadian import of Mike Flanagan's movie Before I Wake, which is still awaiting a U.S. release.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so we watched it, and I thought it was great.
It's amazing.
Like, really, really,
I loved it.
It's more emotional drama than anything, because it really does revolve around a couple that lost their child, and now they are taking in a foster child, and the foster child has this weird gift where kind of his dreams and nightmares kind of come alive whenever he goes to sleep. And I just thought it was beautifully executed, and it does have a lot of scares in it. And I just, like, Mike is just like, he's one of those guys. Like, I saw Oculus when it came out, I liked it a lot. And now between Hush and I really liked his Ouija movie, basically anything he does, I'm like fully on board for. And I thought Before I Wake, it's a sin that it's not out here, because Kate Bosworth is great and she's the lead. But let me tell you, the most valuable player there is Thomas Jane. And
I
always liked Thomas Jane. I think this is the best performance he's ever given in anything. Like, he really, I believe him as the heartbroken dad.
Right.
And he's doing everything he can to get this kid to come out of his shell. And I just kept thinking to myself, I was like, man, he's like really good in this. Like, much better than, you know, and again, I like him in most things, but I think it's a sin that nobody's getting to see his performance in this movie, because it's great. Yeah. But Before I Wake, Mike Flanagan, again, the Canadian Blu-ray is all region. Mm-hmm. So you can pick it up and you
can
watch it.
Is there no future for a release here?
No, I think they're still trying to work it out, because
it's part of relativity, but I think that they're looking for a new buyer, I think.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But I think it's totally worthwhile. Yeah.
Cool.
Loved it.
I'm down to see.
So I watched Godzilla versus Mothra from 1992.
Yes.
And this has always been one of my favorite Godzilla movies. And my daughter loves Godzilla, so she sat with me through this whole thing. And I have to say, this one is one of my favorite, because, well, one, Mothra is just the most huggable of all the monsters. Like, he's fluffy and he throws glitter at people. He really does. Like, if you go back and watch it, Mothra leaves like a trail of glitter. This one, it's weird. It's from 1992.
It's one of the revamped, like, after Godzilla versus Biollante.
Yeah.
It's like the revamped shit.
But it's like the Cosmos twins are in it, and they sing and have all this cool dancing and their matched outfits. And they talk to Mothra and they tell him to come attack the city. But then once he does, the little girl's like, no, don't attack our city. And then they tell him to stop. And the villain in it is Batra. It's kind of confusing, because you've got Godzilla gets dropped into the ocean via meteor. And then that causes the seas to raise. It raises the sea level. Plus, people have been fucking up the world. It's Godzilla, so there's always like a climate, environmental side to it. And people have been destroying the world and taking down the forests and everything, and it's causing all these typhoons. And then Godzilla shows up, but then because people are messing up the environment, it wakes up Mothra. And then because Mothra's awake, it wakes up his arch nemesis, Batra, who is also a giant caterpillar who turns into a big moth who throws lightning bolts from a horn. In general, this one's it's just fun. Yeah. I had such a blast with this one. I've always loved Mothra, just because I really kind of wanted to understand the pitch behind that one. Like, we've got all of these kind of dragon-esque dinosaur, really scary creatures, but you know what's really fucking terrifying? A moth.
Yeah.
But Mothra, he's just fuzzy and cute.
Every once in a while, I have to sit back and just like rewatch all of the Godzilla movies.
Yeah.
And I have my particular favorite, Smog Monster, Godzilla Godzilla versus the Smog Monster really messed me up as a kid because there was an animated sequence in which you saw the Smog Monster fly over the city, and there was like a kind of a trippy 60s song that went with it, and the Smog Monster would fly over Tokyo and drop its smog and into the streets, and then people would turn into fucking skeletons and die. And then they remembered, like, they showed some cat stuck in tar, and I was like, oh my god. It was terrifying. Yeah. But
this one is not scary.
No, not so scary. Yeah. I remember Godzilla punching through the Smog Monster and pulling out these orb egg things, and I was like, oh, what the fuck is going on?
Wow.
Very weird.
This one, not scary, very accessible for kids, so your kids will enjoy it. Although Marnie was confused because Batra is not a bat.
I was confused as well.
I know. When she looks at me and she goes, Mommy, why is Batra not a bat? And I'm like, I don't know. And then because she's four, that frustrated her worse. And then she had to ask it like six more times throughout the movie. And I'm like, I just don't know, honey. Shut up and enjoy the damn movie. So that is Godzilla versus Mothra from 1992.
Nice.
I popped in Akira to show the anime loving child, and she loved it. I haven't seen that in like probably like 15, 20 years. Holds up. So great. Crazy fucking movie. But what I really want to talk about, I read a book over the weekend called Someone Is Inside Your House by Stephanie Perkins. It's coming out in 3 weeks. Becca, you're going to love it. It's a young adult novel, but someone just pitched me on it, and I was like, oh, slasher? Cool. Great. I'll read it. It's basically about this girl named Akani who is from Hawaii. She's running from a dark past. Her parents relocated her from Hawaii and stuck her in Nebraska with her grandmother, where she's staying there. Slowly but surely, someone is offing all her classmates in really, really grisly ways. The killer, basically, his MO is he'll sneak inside your house and basically just misplace things and turn things around. So when you walk into your room, you're like, oh, wait, why is my room backwards? And while you're trying to make out why exactly all of this is happening, the killer comes in and then fucking kills you in a brutal way.
So this is young adult?
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, no.
I'm thinking like Christopher Pike and Lois Duncan, where that part was kind of glazed over.
No, Perkins does not hold back. I mean, like, I felt like I was reading Thomas Harris at times. Wow. I was just like, damn. But it's a really, really solid read. I had a great time. It's a quick read. It's really good. And it was a nice pairing because I read this other book, Final Girls by Riley Seeger, I think her name is. Shit, I'm blanking on the name. I read it earlier this year, and that was a little bit more soap operatic, I felt.
Yeah, I
you
didn't
read it
enjoy
too?
Final Girls
okay,
this
we'll talk
much.
About, yeah. It was,
yeah, it was, it wasn't my thing.
It's basically
thing.
About final girls, like girls who endure brutal slayings at like either campgrounds or a hotel in this case, and how they all banded together and they were all in the media spotlight, but suddenly one by one they're being picked off.
Okay.
But the focus isn't the picking off. Now, and I mean, not that you can't get away from that, but it just was a little too emotionally charged for me.
Yeah.
For me to really get into.
I just enjoyed that I got to read over the summer two very slasher themed novels.
What was the name of this last one that you were talking about?
There's Someone Inside Your House.
Okay.
Yeah, good stuff. Elric?
Just a couple of real quick ones. I did watch the premiere of the new season of American Horror Story last night.
Oh.
I haven't finished a season for the last three seasons. I tend to watch the first, like, I watch like 8 out of 10, and then I'm just like, I can't finish. It just, there's something, it burns me out, man. Like,
they
just throw too much at you.
The past few, they've burned themselves out to
just
the point where
story.
They like, they throw so much stuff. And then by like the fifth episode, I'm like, I don't even know what the fuck's going on anymore. That's what happened this last season.
So how was
this one?
This one, I mean, it was interesting. It might be a little too close to home. It's basically night of the election, and Evan Peters is basically thrilled that Trump won, and everyone else is devastated. And he takes a Cheez-It and then paints his face orange.
Cheetos.
And then he puts his hair up and starts doing Trump impersonations in the mirror. And you're going, what? It's almost like a weird fucking fade to black
I can't
moment.
Can't wait to watch this.
I know. I'm like,
it's
more
pretty bonkers.
Now.
And then everyone else is crying because Hillary lost. And then basically him and literally a posse of clowns start terrorizing everyone and treating people like shit on the streets, like just going up to a woman and going, "You're a bitch, fuck you," and walking away because he can now. So the cool thing about it, I will say this, I like that they're diving and saying now, because some of the ones set being said in the past, you're already over it. So it's interesting, but it's also a little hard to watch because it is really
it's an immediate
now.
Reaction.
Yeah, yeah, and you're kind of visceral. I also just don't know, the clowns felt maybe like that's a little played out, but then hey, maybe with it, that's going to be great timing for them. Besides that, I couldn't tell you what it's going to be about. I mean, it moved pretty fast. I mean, a lot of crazy shit happened in it.
Yeah. I like the imagery that's being paired with the P&A campaign, because it's like honeycomb and bees paired with clowns. So it's like this interesting dichotomy.
The honeycomb
did
look cool. That hasn't come up in episode one, so I'm curious where that was. The cool thing about the first episode is you couldn't tell someone exactly where it's going to go. You just kind of know the setting.
Yeah, with the bee imagery, I was thinking like drones, slaves, you know, all that kind of stuff. So
that's
interesting. I bought the season on iTunes because there's like a 24-hour delay. I have to watch it. So I'm going to watch it after we record tonight.
Yeah, no, but I think it's worth people checking out because maybe it'll be more interesting. And then just lastly, this one's quick because most people seen it. I rewatched, I'd been working my way through all the Luden films again. I still had a lot of them from TCM on my tape. I rewatched I Walk with a Zombie for the first time in like 20 years. I've
Is
always loved it.
Is that the racist one?
Well, you just said that last week.
I'm pretty sure it's the racist one.
Anything from that period about that kind of stuff is racist. I don't think it's necessarily a racist film at all. It's just got people that have slaves in it. It's the setting is racist. But it's such a beautifully made movie. It's so interesting. It's really not. None of his films are really horror. They're definitely in opposition to what was happening at Universal, and he did that on purpose. Like he really did not like what it was. Universal bored him. And so he would go, "Well, I want to do my own thing." And I think he knew it wasn't really horror. It was just pure a lot of dread and a lot of beautiful sequences, kind of a bit like the sequence we're talking about from Hitchcock's Stranger on the Train, a lot of sequences like that. But the reason I want to bring it up is I did because Brian Sauer has introduced this amazing podcast. There's only been like six episodes, but three of them, and there's going to be a couple more, are just on this period of Luden. And it's like, what is that podcast where she does like the Manson sequence?
It has that
kind of production value. So it's high production value. It's this British guy. He's playing all the characters, telling you the biographical story. So it doesn't feel like a podcast like what we do where we just talk. And he does the first one talking about Luden's past, and the next one is about cat people. And they're so interesting. It's like the history of RKO. And it's called The Secret History of Hollywood. And the first three episodes are, I guess, about some gangster films. I haven't listened to the first three, but the next three and the fourth will be, I'm hoping it's about Seventh Victim, my favorite one.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's really the best thing I've heard this year. Like, I was like in my car not even wanting to go to work because I had to finish his story, because it's like being told a great story.
Right.
More like an audiobook. Anyway, definitely give it a try. The Secret History of Hollywood.
And just on iTunes?
On iTunes with it, and the fourth episode should drop soon. But he must put some time and money into it because it doesn't feel cheap, you know?
Right.
But it really is a nice echo, especially if you haven't jumped into Luden, you could listen to one and then watch that film, and I think you'd get a lot more out of it because there's a lot happening behind the scenes in old Hollywood. It's very cool.
Wow.
Cool. Eric, cool. Anything else?
Well, when I was setting up earlier today, getting the VCR and TV going, I popped in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh, yeah.
I was just watching it as I was working, and obviously a classic, but I just found myself laughing every once in a while.
Yeah, I heard you chuckling. I was like, what's he laughing at?
Their dialogue is just like, way they write, it's just back then was just like, they had to explain everything, like, and it was just like really funny how like they spend a whole like 15 minutes explaining something and how it's going, so you know why it's happening. Well, it's happening because of this, and this, and that. And so that's why I was laughing and stuff like that.
It's like, Doctor, how does it? Yeah. What is an atom? Jimmy and Adam makes up the atoms.
Yeah, I think you need to avoid scientists in movies like that. If you didn't have that, it makes it so much more scary.
It kind of reminds me of those reality ghost hunting shows where every time they explain to you what EFP or whatever electric voice phenomenon is, and then every time they mention the acronym, they have to tell you what it is. And it's just like, you did that 5 times in the last 15 minutes. We know what it is.
I was always that movie. I remember I used to have this professor back in college that heralded that as like one of the first female empowerment films, because she's a scientist in it. And I'm like, does she do any science? No, she goes swimming.
She swims real good.
She swims.
Really?
That's
she
it.
Do any science.
She does not do science.
I think it was Return of the Creature. I think it was like, God, I mean, I was like 15. I saw it. And at the beginning of Return of the Creature, you got these two like bros like on a boat, and they're like, "Oh, it's so hot outside, I can go for a nice cold beer," and the guy goes, or a nice warm blonde. even my hormonal 15-year-old, I want to sleep with everything. I was like, grown. That's embarrassing. Jesus Christ.
Wow. But there's a female hero of that movie, and it's behind the scenes.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Allison.
Well, yeah.
Who created the creature, which is, I always wish someone to make a little movie about that. Just that. It just
like
seems
a little like Ed Wood.
Yeah. It just seems like what an amazing thing that a lot of people probably don't even know.
So speaking of the Creature from the Black Lagoon, I mean, the reviews for The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro's movie out of Telluride, holy crap.
I heard John Landis had tears running down his face. He was so
watching the trailer, guys.
100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I was like, oh my God, this trailer, this movie, I cannot wait.
And I would say it's about time, Guillermo, like personally. I feel like he's, for me, the last couple, there's just been something about them. They look beautiful, but there's just, I just don't connect. And I feel like it's time he makes that movie he really just died.
Well, I feel like, because it's an actual monster.
Yeah.
Instead of Crimson Peak, where it was beautiful, but they were these like CG, hard to kind of fathom things.
Yeah. It's his creature. It's his creature.
Yeah,
I know he was supposed to remake with David J. Scowl, wrote a version of it. And David, you know, commented, he's like, some of this looks pretty familiar, but... You know, but he said it in a way that's like, you know, if Universal's not going to let him make it, he might as well make his own.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
That's what all these guys should do, quite frankly, is make their own version of these movies. So I'm looking forward to it.
Rob, you got anything else you want to add?
I got one last thing and then some quick reminders for everybody. But Rodman Flender, who's a friend of the show and responsible for our guests, so he'll come up again later. He picked me up a copy of Shin Godzilla on Blu-ray, the newest one.
Thank you for the reminder. No, it's in my queue, and I'm like the number one person who should have seen this when it hit, and I keep missing it.
Let me break it down for you. I loved it. I had a great time watching it. It is 2 hours long. It's a long movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It is probably one of the most dense pieces of material I've ever seen, because it is like, be prepared to read a lot, because it is a lot of dialogue. There's so many characters, and there is no main character. It is basically it's a reboot of Godzilla. So pretend no other Godzilla movie exists. This is the Christopher Nolan reboot of Godzilla. I think Andrew Cash is like, it's like Dunkirk, except it's Godzilla that shows up.
Oh my gosh.
And I mean, literally, it's about all, cool. like, you literally, like, the pacing of it, it feels like an American movie, because the pacing of how many people have to make a decision before anything happens.
Right.
Like, that's what it is. It's like, something's come on shore. All right, let the Secretary of State know. And then it cuts to that person, and it cuts to them going to the president. And it's like, it's so freaking bonkers, like the political side of what would happen if Godzilla showed up.
And is the political side saying something, at least? I mean, is it like kind of like The Host, where it's got commentary? Okay.
Subliminally, because the U.S. keeps wanting to get involved. So underneath it, the subliminal message is, It's basically, they're saying, how badly, who can fuck up Godzilla more, the Japanese or the U.S.?
Oh.
That is their very not so subtle message. Is like, the Americans want to get involved, but they're probably going to make it worse. Like, so it's
interesting.
I had a lot of fun with it. It's totally different from every other Godzilla movie.
My impression was it was going to be a rebirth. I thought, all the images show like a kind of a fiery Godzilla. I was like, he's reborn.
I don't want to give this away because it was the most fun surprise for me. Yeah. But early on, like, a creature shows up and it's almost so goofy that I'm like, what am I watching? But the kind of reveal and twist about that was so cool. I was all right, I'm in.
Great.
But no, I think it's great.
Good, good.
And reminder wise, I just wanted to say Amsterdam is on Blu-ray from Blue Underground. Mm-hmm. I rewatched it last night with a couple of the kids from the Scream Show, because we do these little movie things, and they were blown away. And it's even better the second time that I saw it. I revisited Aliens, the James Cameron one. Scott Reynolds was doing Sunday backyard screenings. And all I have to say about that is it makes me hate Alien Covenant even more than I already kind of did. I mean, I was kind of like lukewarm on the movie, but then anytime I see Alien or Aliens, I'm like, this is enough.
Yeah.
I need nothing more than these two perfect movies.
Yep.
So that's that. And then the other thing was, because it is coming out as of today, and because somebody in our group gave the original TV movie like 1 star. I was like, this is not 1 star. I was like, look, I just watched Dreamstalker, the movie you recommended. I was like, That's a one-star movie.
Wait, what is Dreamstalker?
Dreamstalker is the shot on video Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, yeah.
Tim Curry gets 2.5 without even doing anything. Well, he just gets 2.5 stars for being amazing.
So I broke out the Blu-ray because it came out recently, and I watched the whole thing with Tommy Lee Wallace's commentary, because there's a commentary with him and some of the cast members kind of pop in. And it's a great commentary because he didn't really know the book going in, so he was basing everything he did off the script. And it was also written by the same guy that wrote Carrie for De Palma.
Right.
So I didn't realize it was the same screenwriter as Carrie. And I still like it. I mean, yes, it's its own entity, and I have a an association with it that's mostly nostalgic because I loved it. I was the age of the kids when it came on TV.
Yeah.
But regardless, some things they get right, some things they don't. A lot of it is – for TV in 1990, I still think it's a marvel. And in particular, some of the stuff that Tommy Lee does directing-wise, like there's one moment basically when they fight it as kids. I just love the way that he keeps panning between each character and what they fear is like in the – like Georgie appears for Bill and then Beverly's dad. Like the way that it pans back and forth and does it all in one shot – I was like, I don't know, man. There's some pretty solid filmmaking going on here, regardless of what you think of the material or whatever. Yeah. So
I'm going to revisit right after because I haven't seen this forever.
And I think that's a good move because you want to judge the new one on its own.
A fresh kind of stuff.
And then it's kind of, because then it'll be a different entity too. Yeah, for sure. So anyway, that's it for me.
Cool.
The last one that I watched, because I'd watched the Bronx movie a couple of weeks ago, I decided to watch the follow-up to it, which is Escape from the Bronx.
Oh, yeah.
From 1983. So this is a couple of years after the original. You can probably stop at the first one. The second one definitely loses some of the charm, where the first one is very much just following the main character of Trash around as he kind of navigates this Warriors-esque landscape with all of these crazy gangs in it. This one is about the government is going in and trying to relocate people out of the Bronx because they want to turn it into like a big, beautiful, like gentrified neighborhood. But they say that they're relocating everybody to Mexico, but they're just exterminating most of them. And so it's this whole like government and company conspiracy. All of the gangs move underground and then fight back. And then there's also this weird mercenary who has like this 7-year-old son who's an explosions expert. Like the 7-year-old is. And it just gets really tedious. So not as great as the first one by any means.
Is that video here? I'm curious.
No.
It looks like something might be.
It feels like it should be. But
All right, Eric. Thank you so much for popping on. And
no problem. Thanks.
Anything you want to plug? Any podcasts or shop stuff?
No, just follow us on Facebook and Instagram, the Mystic Museum and Bearded Lady Vintage, and please come to the show. If you can't come to the opening night, September 9th, then just come by anytime because that'll be up for at least 2 months.
Yep.
Yeah. Is there an admission on the normal days?
Yeah, there is an admission. It's $10. You get 2 shows. You also get the museum, which is the mystic part of the museum, which is all mystic stuff. It's very authentic, original pieces, antique pieces. You get the Ben Cooper show. You get the Slashback show. You get a free trading card and pin with every entry. So it's actually well worth it. And then expansion. So we are double the size now. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Eric, it's been awesome doing this with you.
Yeah.
And thanks for popping on. And let's bring on our next guest.
Great. Thanks.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within 1 day. No juggling emails, no calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. That's ZipRecruiter.com/shock. One more time, try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/shock.
Okay, and welcome back to the show. This is pretty exciting. In honor of Slashback Video, I kind of wanted to kick off September as a VHS slash video-centric kind of month. We'll see if we can keep up with it. But I was out at the movies with my friend Rodman Flender, and he was telling me that he knew the owner of Cinephile, which is a great video store, one of the modern video stores that is still up and running. It's over in Santa Monica right next to the New Art.
Yep.
And so when he told me he knew the owner, which is Mr. Sebastian Matthews, I was like, we got to get him on the show. So welcome to the show, Sebastian.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you all. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. And so not only do you own, you also own Touch Vinyl and Cinephile.
And that's the vinyl place around the corner that always looks like a club, but they also sell records.
Exactly right. It's we had to find new revenue streams to support the vinyl sales.
Is the hookah bar also yours around the corner? I was past that hookah bar. Okay.
Not yet. But it seems like tobacco is also that's a good thing to get into.
But Touch Vinyl seems like a smart idea, because it's like, is there a bar, a coffee shop in it, and then some records? And so people go in there, and every single time I go in, it's more like people hanging out, drinking, talking about records, and here's some to buy.
Yeah, I was inspired by record shops in Scandinavia, actually, and almost all of them have some sort of, you know, slash coffee bar slash living room. And so that was an important aspect for me, and that was my first baby. That was 5 years ago we started.
Wow. Well, I do want to go back to the beginning at some point, and I already know we're all over the place already, but let's talk about that. So Touch Vinyl was the first shop, and were you always involved in Cinephile, or did that come much later on?
No, I had become friends with the previous owner, Phil Anderson, just because I worked at Touch and was on the block and was renting constantly from Cinephile on the free, you know, on the block account. And so we got to be friends. And then as the years went by, I guess it was the end of year two at Touch, Phil had told me that he was interested in closing, and he wasn't sure if he was going to close and do a smaller iteration on the east side or whether he was just going to completely liquidate the inventory. And I already knew that there was sort of this trickle-down economy on that block, from people going to the New Art Theater for great screenings and then stopping in at Cinephile to check out movies and then coming around the block for the records and sometimes hookah.
Yeah. Occasional hookah. Yeah.
And, you know, just I know this is kind of a big question, but, you know, we're in a vintage video store right now. What are the things that we wouldn't think about when it comes to maintaining and running a modern video store in today's day and age? Because they do still exist. And Cinephile does have a great selection. That's one of the things. And also, aren't there like weird perks for like students and stuff like that where you can, what are some of the rent? Rodman was explaining to me, but.
Yeah. So, I mean, first and foremost, I think, you know, as the fragmentation becomes greater and greater online, where it's like, okay, now I have to pay $8 for my Netflix and $14 for my HBO and a little bit for Disney, and it'll continue to fragment, I think.
Yeah.
People start to get more peace of mind from being able to go to one place. And if they're lucky enough to be in sort of commuting or walking distance from Cinephile, then it becomes a great option, even if the monthly membership's a little more pricey. And monthly membership is something that I felt was a really important thing to institute, because I didn't want late fees to be the central dynamic of how we stayed alive. And I think it's something that has been a bad taste in people's mouths since Blockbuster and that idea that if you didn't return something, you were paying exorbitant costs to replace it and all of that. So, you know, getting it down to a monthly membership model of $30 a month, where people could rent 4 movies a day, up to 120 movies a month, with no late fees, was just a huge amount of value. And we had to figure that out. In fact, the student membership that you mentioned was my first foray into trying to figure out what value the movies had. So I said, let's pretend the value is zero and give these away rent for free to film students, to the people that might care.
Right.
And so we immediately had about 250 signups from USC and 100 from UCLA. And yes, the goodwill went really far. And in fact, one of the USC students ended up shooting his short film entirely in Cinephile and renting out the space. And he did a great job. So it was wonderful just to see, okay, there is that interest. Now let's figure out the pricing. Let's, you know, slowly figure out the pricing. And what we did at first was a tiered membership. So people who had been members started at $20 a month. And then after we reached 100 members, we then bumped it up by $5, and it was $25 a month, then 30, 35, 40, every 100 members. So once we reached 40, then we said, okay, let's just not go crazy, and sort of pushed everybody to 30. The 20s moved up to 30, and the 40s moved down, and that's become kind of the sweet spot.
Do you guys still have the gold cards and stuff where you get 10 films? Because that's what I'm on. I think I've got like 7 left, but it's, I need to catch Hitchhiker Ride out there.
Yes, yes. And I'm glad you mentioned it because yours is still valid, yeah, but we actually
those other punks?
Them out.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it'll still show up on my account, right?
Exactly. We load it to your account now, and you can still buy packs, and uh-huh. we just basically put it on the account. But it turns out a naughty former employee had handed out stacks of gold cards.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, it's funny when I looked back at sort of some of the reasons the shop wasn't working. I mean, Phil was an absolutely great owner, but you know, there were just these little holes of, like, you know, some people just being too nice about letting late fees slip or letting movies get lost or giving out gold cards.
This is an honest story. This is one of the reasons I moved to LA with Cinephile, because I went to Irvine for a year, and we didn't get up to LA very much. The one time we came up to LA, because a friend of mine, this is like 2002 or it was a long, it must have been early in Cinephile. I remember walking in there, and I had worked in really cool video stores in New Zealand, but they were pretty much more like what we're looking at now. I'd never been in one in my whole life where it was by director.
Yeah.
And I literally just fell in love. Yeah. And I literally remember, so when I was deciding whether to actually move to LA in the long run, Cinephile, and then I saw a couple of films at the New Beverly one time, and I was like, yeah. And then I just didn't realize I'd live so far away from Cinephile. So the first little while I lived in West Hollywood and would drive out there almost every weekend. And then I finally ended up in Santa Clarita. Now it's like, oh God. Now it's like a day trip, but it's going to be worth it. For October, I plan on doing it, you know.
Yeah, and I'm still amazed by the amount of destination shoppers there are that come from the east side, from Echo Park and that sort of distance. And, you know, a lot of the shops closed last year, Video West, Video Journeys, Video Store New Desire.
Rocket Video was near New Beverly.
Laser.
Yeah.
So, and I think that is the other crucial factor. It's that at least, well, we know that LA can support one and maybe at most one of these big, rare collectors.
It could be even different parts of LA, too.
Exactly.
It's such a bifurcated place. Yeah. But the thing is, they don't, it's not, you know, it's that beautiful thing where you, like, Herschel Gordon Lewis or somebody like that will be next to Werner Herzog, who will be next, you know, and it's like there's just no, it's highbrow, lowbrow. And I really think that's the key. And most big video stores, Scarecrow in Seattle, most ones that are still around have that quality because they just love fucking movies.
We had that in New York at, Kim's Underground. Yeah. It was by director, or at least there was a section by director. And then it did, they also did the same thing that you guys do, where then it got really, really niche into subgenres where it was like the sexploitation.
The horror section is very good for that.
Kim's Underground is the first time I saw the term nunsploitation.
Yeah.
I was shopping there as a kid, and I'm like, what is that?
The
like
section out there that I always look at that laugh at every time I've gone there is a hospital horror. There's a whole section on hospital horror or Christmas horror.
I can't even remember the name of it, but it's like, what the fuck?
Holy fucking
shit. Okay, holy fucking shit. And it's like, that's really all you need. The apple is in there. Yeah, that's like, that section was like made for me.
The room? Oh, wait, what else is in
holy fucking shit?
A couple other things we've talked about. I mean, I don't know if The Visitor was there, but it should be now.
Yes, it is. Yeah,
but back, the thing is, the one difference I noticed, like, I haven't been there maybe a few months ago, but was starting to bring in the Blu-rays. I feel like it's something that could really keep a modern video store alive, because there are a lot of Blu-rays, let's say Code Red or something, that I really don't want to buy, but I really want to watch.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's become really a buyer thing. It's like a Blu-ray is a thing you have to buy, basically. And I think there could be a whole nother life on the rental market.
For those rare titles.
For just Blu-rays in general, like a place that just has all the new Blu-rays.
Right.
And some of these are ones that, like, I really want to see the film, but they're not available I'll use The Slayer, for example. Yeah. Not available anywhere anywhere else, and it's going to be really hard to find kind of that quality, but that's going to cost a fortune, and luckily Turk brought me a copy tonight, but otherwise that would be one that I would sit there and I'd go, man, I don't want to buy this, but I really want to see it, but I don't want to buy it.
So have you noticed the Blu-ray market change rentals at all? Or
I think there's definitely more interest, and we sell region-free Blu-ray players in the shop, so allows people only to get into our region-coded library, but as well as, you know, up to Blu-rays, because we have a lot of, like, older customers who didn't want to make that move at first. And then, we've been collecting Blu-ray about as long as the format's been around, so that section has grown and grown, and now we're kind of at that point where we need to integrate that Blu-ray section into the general library.
I guess because, you're already full.
Exactly.
So it's just like anyone's video collection at home. Yeah. You're like, you suddenly buy, you order space. It perfectly, and then you're like, now what do I do?
we've been really lucky. We've made some beautiful partnerships with Criterion, with Kino, Arrow, Shout Factory, and Scream Factory, and Vinegar Syndrome. And all of those companies, I just sent a letter saying, you know, I have a deal with Rentrack and Vobile to get all of the major studio releases for $1 a pop. And so my wall just looks like Marvel movies from here to forever. You know, if you want this store to remain, you know, tasteful, and if you want your fan base to find you, then help us out. So we've got these great partnerships in place, and I certainly encourage any smaller labels that take themselves seriously in that way to always reach out to us, because there's such a good cross promotion value there.
Do you rent by mail?
Not yet. I mean, it'd be awesome to figure that out. And I've looked into, you know, that the old Netflix style one where they just sent the disc in the case.
Well, a good one to look at is the one I worked at for a while, Facets in Chicago. They've been doing it forever. But way before Netflix was announced, they were doing by mail. And they have a kind of models, rental models like you with the $30 a month kind of thing. And they have a really loyal, older for the most part, clientele. But like every day we would be doing that for the first hour of the day is just packaging up all the discs.
And it functioned as a retail
as well,
rental
yeah.
as well.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. yeah but it was a nonprofit, and it still is. It has a little theater, too. Big video store in Chicago. But
got it.
But it's. I think that's just all these ways that you can keep doing what you're doing, I think, are it's integral. Are there other things like maybe being a distributor of a certain label? Has that ever crossed your mind?
To some lesser extent, you know, maybe creating a label and curating a little bit because each of the employees is just such a wealth of knowledge. And always has ideas for screenings and things that could be restored. But I always felt that there was an opportunity to create sort of a federation of video rentals around the nation in which we could receive submissions for films that could show up for rent and for sale at each of our stores. Yeah. So, you know, you could submit at a local shop in Illinois, and then that shop could say, oh, this film is great, send it out to the Federation as a digital file and then burn copies and have it as a distribution model so that, you know, the 3,000 fans of each of these shops could be put on to independent film.
I like that you just called it the Federation. That could be all sorts of ideas about VHS and Star Trek, Federation.
Yeah.
That's right.
I sometimes call it the USS Cinephile.
Oh, really?
Awesome. Do you guys go out of your way to find really rare and hard to find titles to add to your library? Because that's something that Rodman always tells me he's always impressed with, is some of the hardest to find stuff, he will be able to find a copy somehow at Cinephile. Yeah.
It's ironic that Rodman was the one who said that, because customers are often the ones that help us get deeper into catalogs. So, you know, I once found a letter to one of our employees, Greg, that said, hey, Greg, here's, 18 of my favorite short films that I burned off of TV, or that I recorded off of TV to VHS and then burned to disc. And, you know, it had like, you know, Twilight Zone featuring the incident at Owl Creek Bridge and all types of really interesting foreign short films and that sort of thing. So that can get added to the library as long as we feel like it's not, you know, stepping on any sort of copyright issues, things like that.
Right.
But Rodman actually brought in a French noir called
Siri Noir.
Yes,
one of my favorites. I love that film so much. I knew where you're going.
And it turned out that we had a copy, but without English subtitles, and so he found a file of the English subtitles and then mashed them together and then made us a copy. And so, yeah, when your customers help you out in that way, it guarantees.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I tell you how obscure it is. I remember once wanting to, I love this, you know, Al Adamson. I was curious about the story of how he was murdered and stuff. And I remember looking up and you were the only place that had even like burns of the E True Hollywood story of that. Like just a burn of it and a Hitchcock E True Hollywood story. And I remember going, oh, wow. So that's what you kind of, it becomes a destination because that's the only place you could go unless you want to do something on YouTube, which is pretty dull compared to, you know?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's cool.
And just briefly, I mean, you mentioned some of the subsections. I think that's one of the fun aspects of, at least when I worked at a video store or discovered something like Kim's Underground, is I feel like that gives stores personality by how deep they go. Like, all right, we have a director section, but then we have a holy, you know, what the fuck or whatever. So, how does that work at your store, and how often do you change it out? Is it like, do you get weird suggestions from very enthusiastic workers that are like, we should do a section on this?
You know, the biggest fights or discussions at least come on the director's wall. So it's really about, you know, who gets one of those hallowed spots on the wall and who deserves to be up there.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, even just before I started, there was very few female directors on the wall. Even like Sofia Coppola wasn't on the wall. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when the guard changed, we started putting up more of the female directors. But then, you know, the genre sections stay mostly the same because, I think everything is falling into, you know, pregnant men or, you know, or non-exploitation, like you said, or, you know, those tropes exist. But the guys at Cinephile have done a really good job of finding the fun ones and the ones that you'll find multiple movies to watch in.
Right. Mm-hmm. Nice. Why don't we go back to the beginning? You know, we always talk about it a lot, and obviously we ask our guests too, but what are your kind of like earliest recollections of the video store? I mean, were you always a movie fanatic, and did you go and rent stuff and try to find like the weirdest shit you can watch? Or what do you remember about growing up with the video generation?
So I grew up in a suburb of Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and there was Potomac, Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like Virginia side. That's where I am.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Right across the river.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And there was a video store called Rocky's Video, and VHS at that time. And I mean, I would go mostly because my parents didn't have cable. Like, we didn't have cable, and I was always just watching movies on UPN 20. That was the station, and it was like Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
I talked about it last week, but did you watch the Kung Fu Hour that they used to have? It came on, it was on UPN, it was on Sunday mornings.
With The Legend Continues?
All I remember is it was called the Kung Fu Hour, and it was like one of my favorite things that were on, and it was UPN 20 as soon as you said that.
Yes. So. I think probably the same ones. Yeah. So yeah, and a lot of Star Trek, Star Trek movies, Wrath of Khan, and then you know, it would be random what they got the license to. So Spaceballs, Police Academy 2, you know, it was always like the sequel. But yeah, Rocky's was my first experience, and it was just being able to watch things that I couldn't possibly see at home. So for me, that was really cool. Yeah.
What about horror wise? What was the first movie to really have an impact on you and really scare you?
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah,
because again, I was watching it somehow. It was on TV, probably super censored and cut and that sort of thing. But I remember getting psyched to watch it and then sitting down to watch it. And then my parents saying, okay, we're going to bed. And then, you know, they shut off the lights and just left me there alone.
Wow.
And by the time, because they couldn't handle it, I'm sure. And I couldn't either. So by the time I realized that he could attack in your dreams, then I was like, no, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
So I watched half. I think I've never finished it.
Wow.
Now, since you were from the area, did you ever go to Video Vault? Alexandria.
No.
That place was, and actually that's where all of my VHSs over there came from. That place was the best, where they did like the classification breakdown, and it's where I saw a ton of crazy stuff. It's cool. Like where I saw Poor White Trash and all of these like absolutely crazy exploitation films. But when they shut down, they sold off everything. Mm. And they went through and found the people who had been like the hardcore patrons of the shop and sent everybody an email 24 hours in advance so we could go in and buy stuff before the rest of it opened up. But that's where a lot of my collection came from.
Cool.
So it was a very bittersweet day.
Yes. What was your video store?
Oh man. I wish I could remember the names. I know there was one called Z Video, but I can't remember if that was the one on the corner. I like forgot all the names of them because it's been that long.
Did they have one in your pocket of the world?
They did. Before, I mean, eventually they had generic ones, not like Blockbuster, but like Video Easy and United Video. But before that, there was a mom and pop. And like you, it's like the name is just like not, you know, I was probably like 9.
If I heard it, now you know it.
To like 13, yeah, and it's just, it was probably something really boring. It was like super, Video Store or some shit.
It was honestly like, it was like Hollywood Video. Before there was an actual Hollywood Video chain, it was like that generic.
Now, Video Vault, the one that I was talking about in Alexandria, I would drive to. That was like a half an hour drive from my house, but it was worth it because they had weird shit. But the one that was really close to my parents' house, I'm tempted to have the logo tattooed. It was called On Track Video. And the actual logo was like a little tape cassette, but the spokes were wheels. And so it looked like a train and it was flying down a like railroad track and it was a film strip. And it was like the coolest little
That's
logo. And they had nothing but horror and porn there, but it's where I grew up.
So. And now you're here.
And here I am.
Gotcha.
On Track Video. Wow.
Sebastian, did you ever work in a video store growing up? Because I think all of us at one point have slung videos.
No. Ironically, most of my retail experience prior to owning the record shop and the video store was at the Apple store.
Selling
iPods in 2005. So
wow, I bet you like records and videos much more.
I do. It was kind of fun trying to convince people that a Mac was a better machine than a PC, but now that boat has sailed and there's no good fight there. Yeah. So the good fight is with obsolete media instead.
Right.
Love it.
What about, you know, in terms of, I think one of the things that I miss about the video store is the human interaction. Yeah. Like, because Netflix is one thing, but you don't get to talk to somebody passionately who recommends something or gets a feel for what you like and tells you, oh, well, you have to see the film, Wes Craven's movies. If you like those, you got to see this.
Well, that's why we're probably all podcasting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, to give people that feeling of like,
what to watch.
Yeah. It probably is. Yeah.
We're the video store clerks to our listeners, I guess,
totally.
In a weird way. Yeah, but what I mean, what's that? I mean, and this can go both for the record store as well. But I mean, what's your relationship like with the people that come in? I mean, at this point, do you consider most of them friends because of how often you talk about this stuff with them?
In a lot of cases, definitely. And, you know, starting the record shop, the other thing that really incentivized me was that I had lived in Los Angeles for maybe 10 years at that point and didn't feel like I could put roots down. I felt, you know, still like a transient, even though I didn't have a place to go. I thought maybe, oh, San Francisco's better. I'm going to go there. Mm. But creating the shop was putting down roots. And the second I did that, LA became just a much better town. You know, my experience of it became better. And I had these, you know, recurring interactions with people that wouldn't flake because they love records or they love movies, you know? And so that was very cool for me. It was just sort of to transform my experience through working at a retail location. And I've always liked the interaction, whether it's sales or critiquing of art and music. So, definitely developed a lot of friendships. And I think that's the only like big benefit of getting your content in a real store as opposed to online. And I told, you know, all of my employees when we started, it's, you know, customer service has to be a number one, because if for any reason they're turned off by the way you behave, then they'd rather deal with the robot online.
Yep. So, exactly.
You know, it's not the world of Clerks and High Fidelity anymore. As much as I'd like it to be sometimes. So I think, you know, coming from that place of customer service, of being receptive, of not judging what people are into, leads to more productive, you know, exploration of film.
Yeah, I mean, I worked at Amoeba here in Hollywood for 2 years, and I think they've eased up a lot. But when I worked there, they were pretty strict about phone you can't have your phone at all. Like,
right.
They really want, because if somebody comes up to you and asks you a question about music or movies and you're looking down at your phone, you're not connected to them.
Right.
So it's like they want you to engage in that conversation and recommend, like, really wear your loves on your sleeve and let people know if they're picking up something you think is cool, recommend two other things for them, because, I mean, that's the only way your business is going to grow.
Yeah.
And then that person will be more inclined, like, oh, I want to go and ask Rob for his recommendations again, rather than, like you said, go to Amazon and click buy. buy, whatever.
Do you have like a rigorous test for new recruits? Because the place where I worked in Chicago actually did. It was like a 50-50 like answer thing. And I got a question about Betty Boop wrong.
The place where...
I still remember. I'm still tortured by it.
Slide. It's all right.
The place where I worked had a quiz too that we had to take. I don't remember. I remember it being geeky, but I don't remember it being very difficult. But the video store I worked at did have a quiz.
No, I've never thought of instituting a quiz. That seems...
Or just arm wrestle and put on over the top.
You guys can make the quiz.
We're going
to
write it.
This doesn't pertain to the video, but I mean, like at Blumhouse, when we bring in our interns, this was when we were, when Alex was running our front desk, she would put together like a little quiz or like a questionnaire. And I would like, I think I threw in, she had a Blade Runner question and I threw in the thing. I was like, who's the thing at the end of John Carpenter's movie?
That's like a trick question. Yeah, you're evil, Turek.
Whoever had the best, the most creative answer would win.
So it's the person who sat there and goes, well, based on Dunkundi's lighting experiment from Rob G's article.
Child's not having any breath form in the air.
Hey, man.
That'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah. I remember when I moved out here, I remember Dave's video on Ventura Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And it was that's where I met Jared Rivet a lot of other really good friends. But did Amoeba do this? I remember at Dave's video... they had a very strict policy because they had a lot of people coming down because they were at the base of the Hollywood Hills on the valley side. So anybody who trickled down from the hills, you know, Frank Darabont or anybody famous, Dave's had a very strict policy about leave them the fuck alone. Like, don't. Like, the staff would be able to talk to them and interact. But if somebody came over and was like, hey, Mr. Darabont, can I get an autograph? They'd be like, out, go, you know, go
well,
away.
Well, if you work there, definitely not.
Absolutely. But, I mean, I'm talking about people, just like other customers. Because I remember, kind of geeking out. Did Amoeba ever do that? Because Amoeba gets its fair share of...
Every single day there was somebody that was
Chris
famous.
I'll never forget Chris Nolan.
He used to go there every Sunday with his kids.
Didn't
Quentin wear a silly suit? Like some bright flora suit?
Yes.
I love that.
I have run into Quentin at Eddie Brandt's before. And then sometimes he'll send Julie, so I've seen her there as well. I've seen a couple of people in Eddie Brandt's.
I'll tell you what my one Quentin story, and I don't think this is too bad, because he's always super nice whenever he came to me. But what I love is he almost talks like one of the characters from his movies.
Yeah.
And so like at Amoeba, because it's such a giant place, you're not really supposed to let people use the bathroom because it's, you know, who knows what people in Hollywood are going to do. But once in Blue Moon, if somebody comes up and asks politely and like, hey, you know, do you have a restroom? It's like, all right, I'll walk you back there, whatever. Quentin could come up to me and say, hey, can I use the bathroom? And I'd be totally fine with it. Yeah. But he came up to me, he's like, hey, listen, I know it's against policy and all, I've been running around all day, and this whole long, drawn-out story in every detail is like, I thought 3 hours ago that maybe I could go, but then I didn't, and then I came straight here, and blah, 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 and I know it's against policy, and I don't want to get you in trouble or anything, but I really need to use the bat, and it's like... Yes, you can use the bathroom.
Totally cool.
You literally just wove a I got a pee Tarantino story.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's kind of fun. That's what it's only because I was like, wow, that was like Tarantino dialogue asking me to come.
In this scenario, do you realize you are the wolf?
Yes.
You solved his problem. You are the man. I love it.
Yeah, that was cool.
Very cool.
So one of the assignments that I dictated to everybody here, which quite frankly, I'm just going to look behind me.
Yeah, really.
It's
too easy here.
He texted us. I love it.
I texted them and was like, hey, I want you to bring some VHS titles, horror titles.
I have four, and they're all here, except for one. One I can't even find a VHS copy of.
Oh, yeah?
So I don't know if you have some rare titles you want to throw into the mix, too, but we, of course, always come with our notes and all that. And I will start with a terrible movie.
Great.
Why not?
Can't wait for that.
Junior. It's a movie called Junior, which is in Slashback Video right now. Right?
Yes, I saw it right over there.
Because he is, he's not Freddy, he's not Jason, he's real, or whatever the tagline is in front. That was more than enough to get a young 12-year-old Rob G excited, and I was like, oh my god, he's more...
Did the fact that the cover art look like Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2?
Yeah, I had to have it, it's this cool, it's this guy, this weird-looking redneck dude, like, sawing, it's an art piece of him sawing through the cover, and they're comparing him to Freddy and Jason. The problem is that guy's nowhere in the movie. and nor is that chainsaw scene anywhere in the movie. I remember just being very long and boring and not delivering on any of the promise, which quite frankly was kind of the luck of the draw when you were renting movies. Like, you could have the most amazing, intricate box, and then you rent it, you watch it, and you're like, why is that awesome cover not anywhere in this? And as I've said, me and my friend Josh Miller want to remake movies where the cover is awesome, but that cover's not in the movie. Like, we want to remake the movie with the cover in the movie so that we can deliver on that promise all these years later.
There's an art gallery across from the record shop that did an exhibition of an artist from, I'm not sure exactly where in Africa, but I think Uganda, where in Uganda they would receive news that they were getting a movie, like Terminator is coming to play in Uganda, and then he would have to make the poster without seeing the film, without knowing.
Are these the flower sacks?
Yeah.
Clive Barker has a ton of these for all of his different movies, and they none of them have anything to do with the movies whatsoever, but
Michael
they're
Jackson
gorgeous.
Will be in the cover, on the cover for some reason, you know, and some elements will be right, like there'll be a little robot eye on Michael Jackson.
They got that part right. Becca?
Excellent. Okay, well, I'm going to start with the one that Elric mentioned, Summer Camp Nightmare, from 1987. This was written by Penelope Spheres, and it is it was kind of like the horror answer to Meatballs, I have to say. Like, it's not a slasher. It's about a summer camp where it's a boys' summer camp, and they get really angry at the counselors being really over-demanding, and the guy who runs it, who, if I remember correctly, is Chuck Connors.
Yes.
I know he's in there somewhere.
That is true.
And so they pretty much stage a mutiny and take over the camp. And then gradually they start spreading out, and they take over the girls' camp across the river too. And everybody's all for it, but then it gets really Lord of the Flies, where it starts dividing up into factions, and then one of the girls gets raped and somebody dies.
Ugh.
And then everybody like splits off, and some people want to stop and go to the authorities, but they're being threatened by the others. And it really is like Lord of the Flies at a summer camp. It's really, it's not like a fun film. It's pretty heavy, but it's good. And I don't know why that's never been released. I know a lot of Penelope Spheres stuff has problems with music. I don't remember it having any crazy music in it. Like, that's why Dudes, I guess, has never
she
been
made
released.
The punk film, right?
Dudes is coming out. Shout
Oh,
Select.
It's about time. That's actually
really? Today.
Oh, it's Jesus. Actually a really fun movie. I've always liked Dudes, but it's got like Wasp and the Vandals and Megadeth's in there. So I always assumed that there was like some music problems with it.
Wow.
But yeah, Summer Camp Nightmare, if you haven't seen it, only
I've been
VHS.
Wanting to revisit that because I have such vague memories of it as a kid, and it did scare me, but anything like Lord of the Flies-esque where kids were being evil always kind of freaked me out.
Yeah, it's too. Definitely so. Like, and it's weird because your alliance changes throughout the movie. Like, it's really smart in that regard, where at first you're like, yeah, these adults are dickheads, overthrow them. Wait, now these kids are dickheads, overthrow them. Wait, those other kids are being dickheads now. And like, it, you change your allegiance the whole time. It really is kind of smart.
Summer Camp Nightmare.
Summer Camp Nightmare.
My whole fear, Rob, to speak of, it's right over Becca's shoulder,
yeah,
Summer Camp Nightmare.
There it is.
My whole fear with the Lord of the Flies scenario, I just didn't want to get stabbed by a stick.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah,
I always had this fear. I mean, it's a genuine fear as a child to be stabbed by another friend, but with a giant spear.
See,
you
mine
know,
was,
I just didn't want that.
Mine was the Asmar thing that eventually my inhaler was going to run out, and I was just going to be panting like Piggy on that island, and it was going to suck.
I'm trying to see which one I want to lead with here, but I might as well just go with one of my favorite horror films, The Keep, by Michael Mann. This is... God, I don't even know if it had a Laserdisc release. I don't know.
It might have.
It got a Japanese... Yeah. Widescreen release.
But it is one of the holy grails.
It really is, yeah. And I don't think Paramount has any interest in releasing
and
it.
And Flashback Video has a poster of it on the wall.
Or Michael Mann, I guess, right? Like, and he
Michael
must be part of the problem. Because I think if he wanted it out, it would be out.
Yeah. And F. Paul Wilson, the writer of the Keep novel, is probably pretty thrilled about that because he is pretty public about how much he hates the film as well. Because,
that's a cool movie, though.
It is a cool movie. Yeah. Well, Michael Mann made it his own, which was, you know, about these Nazis and... and during World War II, who roll into a village, and there's this giant keep, and it's kind of like a spin on the Gollum story, you know?
Yeah.
They peel these Nazis are after the silver that's within the keep, and they pull it open, and a block falls from a wall and unleashes an ancient evil, and the ancient evil starts to basically piece itself back together from, you know, muscle-bound form to skin form to something that's very hulking and weird.
Okay, that's enough. I want to see it.
Yeah, no, you should see it.
It's great.
Who was going to say? Ian McKellen is in it.
Oh, nice.
Ian McKellen, who is wearing old age makeup and looks like he does now. Like, yeah. But so I can't even imagine. I mean, like, you do see a young-ish version of him in this film. Who else? Gabriel Byrne is in it. Yeah. But a great score by Tangerine Dream. Really beautiful imagery.
What happened to it? When at the time, like, I remember it coming out, but what happened after that? Why did it become a film that was hard to...
I have no idea.
Yeah, that's
no
idea. Somebody out there.
I honestly think it's just because Paramount was like, we just want to watch
what
our hands
on
this. Yeah, we don't know what this is.
And man not wanting it out there either is kind of...
Yeah, which is so ridiculous. Yeah.
It's a lot better Nazi horror film than the one we are named after. Let's just call it for what it is.
It is.
Shockwaves is a better name, but not in this movie. Well, there's you know, there's always Fright Night 2, but you know, technically that had a DVD release of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot. You know, it's so hard. My favorite is still, and I've talked about it on here a million times, but I want people to put it out one day, is The Black Room. I've got it over there in my section.
Yeah.
Really want people to discover that one. There's one that just got announced that is coming out, so this is good news. You know, it's The Kindred. And I love The Kindred, but that's big news that it's going to get a Blu-ray release soon.
Yeah.
Because that is, to me, it's like one of the definitive VHS type of movies.
Yep.
It's the thing. Okay, and I don't want to rag too much on The Slayer, but the difference is in movies when you discover some box with great art. Some of these movies, even if they're not best movie ever, they just deliver on the promise of goopiness or gore or some quality, nudity, whatever it is. They deliver at least that, you know. And that and when you get one that didn't, you often would fall for it a couple times over like the course of a few years of re-renting it. I can't remember which mine was, but I had one of those that was constantly disappointing me, and I'd go, oh,
you'd rent it every time.
Yeah, and rent it every time. But no, there's something about The Kindred and just the effects, the watermelon. It's a really strange movie. The poster art, the VHS cover, like a monster literally in a baby's bottle of milk. It's genius. And so just even being able to talk about it right now with the idea that you'll actually get to see that on, it's kind of like when I talked about Society a couple years ago, I never would have thought that would come out on a Blu-ray, and then it does. And it's,
we live in good times.
We do.
Yeah.
You know, so
we're very lucky.
So keep an eye out for that one, because I think this way you'll get to see it in a pristine form soon.
Yeah.
It's a really fun movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crappy in some ways, but in all the right ways, you know, which is good.
So. Wow. Sebastian, do you have one for us, or shall we keep rolling?
No, you guys are way deep track.
Okay.
Deep track.
All right, so then
keep rocking.
Recommendations.
Here's one that I donated to Slashback Video, because and actually it was Mike Williamson who even led me to know it existed. It's Stephen King's Night Shift Collection. And this is weird because it's not really a feature. It's two shorts.
Yeah. He showed one of them at Jump Cut.
And
on
yes,
16.
And one of the shorts is it's The Woman in
oh
the
my
Red.
Gosh,
the
I
Woman in the Room,
that.
Directed by some guy named Frank Darabont.
That's right.
First thing he ever did. And the other one is by Jeff Shiro called The Boogeyman.
And he came to.
And that is the one that Mike Williamson had a film print of and showed, and the director came. Yeah.
That's
and this
good.
Was a period where I believe Stephen King was just, you know, he would option out his short stories for like a dollar or something like that. So these were the two guys that came to him first. You know, and obviously Darabont went on to do a lot of them, but they did a VHS release of these two shorts together. And it's pretty cool. I mean, right now with Stephen King resurgence, it's just nice to know that this exists, and it's a, I mean, this is the only format I've ever seen it on is VHS and a film print of one of the shorts. So I think this is super cool. Stephen King's Night Shift Collection.
That reminded me of his The Graveyard Shift.
Yes.
Is that on Blu-ray?
No. Wait. Not Graveyard. That's
it
the one with
sense.
The... It's on... it came out on DVD.
Yeah, it's on DVD. Okay.
But I don't think they ever did a Blu-ray of... I don't know if people are hammered for that one, but maybe. It's probably inevitable.
Excellent. Yes. Okay. So my next one, this is such a fun film. Like, I wish more people saw this. Blue Monkey from 1987. My copy of it is sitting on the shelf over there. This is a Canadian film directed by William Fruitt, who ended up doing a ton of TV. He did a whole bunch of the Friday the 13th TV show episodes, and he ended up doing like a shit ton of Goosebumps episodes.
He did a lot of Kinexploitation too.
Yeah, he did. So the whole concept is like this guy is working in a greenhouse. He gets bit by this weird bug. bug. He gets really sick from it, has to go to the hospital. He, this larval thing that looks almost kind of the hidden isk, kind of comes out of his mouth, and then it retreats to this wing of the hospital and starts growing exponentially. And so it's a creature feature, and it's gooey, and it's gross, and it's got, you know, different forms because the monster keeps growing and evolving, and no one has seen this movie. And I love this movie, so I want more people to check it out. It's really just plain fun. The name Blue Monkey comes from one of the character or one of the characters in the film is describing a nightmare that he has, and it's about a blue monkey. So it's the name of the film. So it's kind of ancillary. The movie's about a giant fucking bug.
I've only seen the trailer, but it looks so great because I was kind of hoping to see that one on a film print one day because I'm sure it will play. Like at an all, I'm expecting an all nighter, and it'll be like the 4 a.m. movie, and I'll be like, yeah.
And I'm gonna be so sad I'm not there because I have been like singing the praises of this film for years, and no one has seen it.
Well, because every time I go to like Monsterpalooza, I look through all the posters, and every time I see a blue monkey, and every time I think of you, and I go, I should buy that for a guy. Eh, I'm poor. But I do think about you, so that's good.
Thanks, Elric. Yeah. So yeah, Blue Monkey, 1987. It's like a long-lost creature feature.
Yeah, Blue Monkey was always one of those titles I saw on the shelf, and I was like, what does this cover say? I have, because it's just like a weird bug.
It's over there, yeah. It's like a nurse holding a weird bug with like a syringe in the background.
A bunch of girls running.
Yeah.
I think I know the movie I kept renting and at this point. I think it was called The Club, and had like a devil horn in the front.
Yes, so yes, that is when Satan tries to convince teens to kill themselves. I have seen that movie many times.
Because the cover was great, I would rent it and then forget about it and think it was like Bad Dreams and then rent it and hate that.
That was when this annoying Satan character like shows up in your bathroom mirror and is like, you know that girl you like? Yeah, she fucking hates you. Kill yourself. And that was like his whole
MO. I have not seen that since being an adult. And it just, when he said the word video cover, it just like flashed into my brain. I was like, yes, Eureka.
I remember
that. It's probably here. I should scour.
That one was more 90s. I remember watching The Club when I was in high school, but that was another one that I definitely rented a couple times, being like, this looks badass. Oh, no, it's like the suicide dude again.
Yeah, not good.
My other title is a film called Project Metal Beast.
Whoa, and it's never heard of it.
From 1995. It's exactly what you think it is. A fucking werewolf with synthetic metal impenetrable skin. But it's about a CIA operation in which these agents go to a remote castle where a werewolf lives to get this blood. And one of the CIA agents injects himself with the werewolf blood. He goes on a rampage in the 70s. They shoot him with silver bullets, put his body on ice. 20 years later, scientists are trying to develop a synthetic skin that, you know, is just basically help you out, you know, ward off bullets and all that shit, because why not? And they decide to use this guy's corpse. And guess what happens? He comes back as a werewolf, and he's got, you know, metal skin, so he's Project Metal Beast.
Wow.
It's pretty spectacular. I remember I was in film school at the time that it came out, and my father would come into town every once in a while, and we would just sit down with, like, I think my girlfriend at the time, she would like make a big dinner, and we'd just sit around and watch bad movies, and Project Metal Beast was one of them. And I had not seen it on video. Like, I saw it on VHS. He taped it off HBO, but then I would see it at the video store all the time, and the cover is so awesome. It's just like a claw tearing through stuff. I wish I could see it again. It's not at Slashback, unfortunately, but I do look on eBay every once in a while and maybe just like buy it.
Wow.
It's a special little movie. It is not good, but it is very enjoyable and just one of those movies that you just go, are you fucking kidding me? Like, why not? Go for it.
Two I'm dying to see. One, because you and way back, remember, it was the A.J. Bone one, The Prey, which I just saw is on here. I still haven't seen it.
It's okay. It's just fine.
It's now a curiosity.
But it's the greatest tagline. It's not human, and it's got an axe.
It's got an axe. I do love it. But the other one, and you guys, I'm curious who of this group has seen it. The cover has always intrigued me, and it's a classic slasher. I'm sure you've seen it, Home Sweet Home.
No.
Okay, so I've always wanted to see that one.
Where is that one?
It's probably here. It's always known as a classic.
I actually think we have it in here somewhere. Yeah,
and it's, again, there's a website.
It's a holiday slasher?
Yeah, I think it's Thanksgiving.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's Thanksgiving, and it's one you just always hear about, and you see the cover, and that's kind of the frustrating thing about what we're talking about in a way, is like they are really hard to find, they're really expensive, and they're only on VHS. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, there's one that I've never seen before, see at the second shelf all the way there, Home for the Holidays with Sally Field.
Wait, it's got Sally Field?
I've never seen it, but the cover, I am fascinated by the cover, where it's a kind of a killer in a yellow rain slicker, and he's holding a pitchfork with red gloves, and
It's Devil's Reign and Deadly Blessing together.
In the darkness of the coat, you see Sally Field's scared face. And I've never heard of this movie before in my life.
We'll share a picture of that.
And it's right next to the Night After Halloween.
I don't know what Home Sweet Home is, but there's a dude dressed up like Kiss holding a guitar.
Oh,
so
weird.
I kind of need to see
this
now.
That's a different cover, though, than the one I'm... It might be the same movie,
but it's 1981, so I assume it's the same. But
there is I'll try to find the site, but a guy... I don't know if it's Rob, or somebody sent me a site once, which is a company that...
Oh, I did a long time ago.
Yeah, it's like... And they back up... Well, technically... on their caveat of why they can sell you a burn of a VHS is that they ask you first if you own that VHS.
Mm-hmm.
And if you own it, they feel like it's fine to sell you the DVD, which I think, hey, that's great. I'm all for anything that's impossible to find for you to be able to get that way anyway.
Yeah.
But I thought that was an interesting way to put it for the legality side of it. But they had that and a number of things like Possession before it was available in the new version, you know, and a lot of stuff. I just can't remember what it was called. I feel like it was like SVHS or something. Maybe it's gone. Maybe the site. Just quickly, and another classic that I talk about, and it's on Becca's shelf. And it's just one of the best... I think it's one of the best horror films not out on Blu-ray or DVD right now, and that's The Haunting of Julia.
Oh, I agree. It's classic horror.
AKA Full Circle. It's just it's just a beautiful performance. It feels like a weird lost Mia Farrow, Rosemary's Baby, like sequel. It's classically directed in a similar way, and it's basically a possession film where she's literally being... It kind of has a bit of a red herring there. I don't want to ruin the spoiler, but you feel like she's slowly being possessed by what she thinks at one point could be her deceased daughter dies in one of the kind of opening sequences. It's a pretty heartfelt, sad film. And then it just becomes this kind of menace child ghost spirit really fucking with her.
Yeah.
And it's actually a pretty scary, effective horror film. And so it's not just like a lot of the schlocky ones that we all love for fun. It's actually like one of those movies that I don't know the reason, but there better be a reason it's not out, because somebody... It could be a Criterion release. It's that kind of quality horror film.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I need to find out. Somebody probably knows the story behind its release. And Keira Dillia is like her husband and a major part of the story. So you've got like A-list, you know, actors.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's just a great film, and it's on Becca's shelf. You can point to it on Instagram.
Point to it here. I have two more. Do you have another one, Rob?
Yeah, but you do your two, and then I'll just... Yeah. I have like one pick, and then ones that I'll just shoot out.
Okay, so I've got... I have a list of like others that I didn't do in detail, but another really fun one that I love is Blood Salvage from 1990, also on my shelf. This one has a full moon sensibility, but it's a little bit better and cleaner than you would find in a full moon film.
Better produced,
thank you. It feels a little bit higher production value than you would find in a full moon film. Well, depending on the time period. I'll equate it to Ghoulies. Okay, it's on a Ghoulies part,
right,
guys.
We'll take it.
So anyway, it's about a mechanic who has two sons. One is kind of smart and the other one's like a man child. And the whole family's MO is that they kidnap people on the road and then connect them to kind of like keep you alive machines. And then they harvest their organs to sell on the black market. And so literally you will be like in their barn hooked up to machines, because it looks like a farm. And so you're in their barn hooked up to machines while they take your kidneys, and then they'll put you on a machine to keep you alive while they, you know, wait a couple weeks till somebody needs a liver, and then they take your liver. Completely morbid premise. But it's zany is the only way I can describe it. Like Elvis is in there, and that's how they explain what happened to Elvis. And they feed them and they come in and talk to them. And it's got a lot of familiar faces with it when you watch it. It feels kind of Motel Hellish in the humor and everything. So it's kind of a fun one that no one else, you know, it's relatively unknown. So that one, it's kind of fun and zany. Another one that is incredibly hard to find, but if you do not miss the opportunity to see it. Tower of Screaming Virgins. From 1968, it was released in the U.S. in 1971. This is a German-French-Italian production, so I pretty much have no idea what came from where. But the whole concept of it
probably produced by Sean S. Cunningham. He has no idea.
He has no idea.
Another one of those films.
The Queen of France and all of her like ladies in waiting have these like crazy torture orgy blood filled sex parties.
Yeah, they do.
And then at dawn, and then at dawn they kill all of the guys involved so that they can't tell anybody. And all of the guys from the neighboring town start noticing, like, have you noticed that all of our young lads are missing? Yeah, this one said that he was going to a party up in the tower last night and then never came back. And so they start to realize that something's going on. This movie does not hold back on the sex, the gore, or anything like that. But what's weird, it's also got swashbuckling scenes in it. So there's some fun swashbuckling. It's the first international film to get an R rating in the U.S. And it was also the first color film to show female nudity. But yet, never been released. I found a copy of it at Eddie Brandt's, and that's the only way I stumbled upon it. But if you ever get a chance to see Tower of Screaming Virgins, really well made, really beautiful, huge, like scenic productions, because it's all during medieval times. So everything's lavish and gorgeous and bright and colorful, and no one's ever seen it. So Tower of Screaming Virgins.
Wow. All right. One of my picks is actually behind us. I wasn't initially going to pick it, but it's a movie from 1988 called Demon Warp. And this is a fun one. It's from the director's Emmett Alston, who also directed New Year's Evil.
Wait, point to this.
So
right behind you.
It is on this.
Two from Summer Camp Nightmare, next to Troll 2.
Oh, thank you.
So, that's how we used to give directions to video stores. Just you hit Eden Live and go to the left.
You get to the elves, you take a right, you turn so you get to Halloween 4, you're there.
You got the Kathy's Curse, you've got too far.
So this is crazy. Here's the synopsis online. It's a man and his daughter are attacked in the woods by what they believe to be a Bigfoot-type creature. However, they soon begin to suspect that they may have stumbled onto a nest of aliens in a hidden spacecraft. Ooh. That man is George Kennedy. What more do you need to know? George Kennedy, Bigfoot that might be an alien, director of New Year's Evil.
And what I love about you saying George Kennedy right in my eye line is just before dawn. So I'm just staring at another George Kennedy.
It's all about the George Kennedy, let me tell you.
And
then,
cool.
Otherwise, there's a handful of sequels. I donated all my video versions of them. Apparently, some of these have gotten DVD releases, but they seem like they're from like weird companies where they weren't really that publicized. And one of them is Relentless, which is a Bill Lustig movie. Kind of a really underrated one. It's pretty mean-spirited in the vein of Maniac, but with Judd Nelson. And what's fascinating about this movie is it's Judd Nelson's a serial killer. Leo Rossi of Halloween 2 fame is the detective that's after him. And Bill Lustig only did the first movie, but then these became there were three direct-to-video sequels.
So
Relentless
weird.
2, 3, and 4.
Oh, yeah.
And Leo Rossi became the lead of those movies. And then he went up against different people. Like, I know William Forsythe is the villain of, I think, 3. So
even more famous than that movie, and this ties into this era, that trailer played before every VHS of that time. I just remember every time I would rent a horror thriller from that period, that trailer played. And it was a great trailer.
Because he
basically picks people at random from
the telephone booth. Yeah.
So it was very memorable. And Judd Nelson, obviously, was coming off being a big teen star. So I remember being like, oh, God, what happened
serial
to him?
Yeah. No, it's a pretty nasty movie, and it spawned a bunch of sequels. And I think there may be DVDs out there, but especially the first one is destined to be rediscovered as a Blu-ray movie. And everyone knows how much I love the Scanners movies. In particular, 1, 2, and 3 are now available on Blu-ray, but I particularly like 4 and 5, and part 4 is called Scanner Cop, which is a police officer that has scanner abilities. And then the 5th one is called Scanners the Showdown, which is a direct sequel with the return of Scanner Cop. And in Europe, it was retitled Scanner Cop 2. So I love that Scanners 5 is also Scanner Cop 2 in certain parts of the world. I have the VHS of this because I never thought it came out on DVD, although again, I think somebody put out a cheapo DVD of them, but I believe that the Scanner Cop deserves a massive comeback in high definition.
I still haven't seen any of those.
Yeah.
I mean, besides Scanners.
I want to throw my last one into the mix. It's the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors.
Oh yeah.
Tape. We do have that here at Slashback, but I don't own my own personal copy, which I wish I did. But it's basically they just took a bunch of cameras to one of the Weekend of Horror shows in the late 80s.
It would have been the late 80s, early 90s.
And I remember it's just a fantastic time capsule of a documentary.
I didn't realize this whole time the Kindred was hanging above me. I didn't even see it until now.
The Kindred's up there. It's a terrific time capsule of a time when things were much simpler on the horror convention scene. Things were much simpler as being a fan, you know, and a lot more. I think there's a lot more enthusiasm depicted on this thing. It's a lot of fun, and it just chronicles from beginning to end one journey through the show.
I will say, I watched it recently. And there it is severely underrepresentative of female horror fans. Like, there's none of us.
I guess we didn't
crawl out of the woodwork until a couple decades later, but you watch it now, and it's like dudes in black t-shirts.
Totally.
Long Island accents.
It's a little goofy too. Well, I think it's like it's a mix, because I thought that was the show that they depict is one in LA or somewhere about there, because I remember when I first moved out here, one of my friends was like, hey, so if you watch like minute two, 34 seconds in, you see me in line at that Weekend of Horror show. Wow. And I was like, oh, that's cool. But it's a little goofy. It's a little fun. But I just wish they would put that. Someone would just put that on DVD or Blu-ray.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day. Who knows?
I got to say, the thing I want to watch most, being here again, is something I have really fond memories of, Transylvania 65,000. When you posted a photo of that the other day, whoever it was between you, as soon as I saw that song, instantly was like,
Transylvania 65,000.
Transylvania 65,000 is hands down one of my favorite comedies of all time.
Oh, really? Man.
I have a DVD of it.
I have not seen it forever.
I absolutely love the movie. I think it is absolutely, I mean, like, any time. There's a moment where Jeff Goldblum and Ed Begley Jr. are trying to like break into an insane asylum, but you can easily just hop over the wall and get in. So what they did is like to get in, Ed Begley Jr. would start climbing the wall, and this nurse would come out and go, "No, what are you doing? What are you doing?" And I forgot what Jeff Goldblum did. Shit, I'm fucking ruining it. But it was funny because he would just go, patient trying to get out. And the nurse would come over and actually pull them in.
Oh, nice.
And they're like, they're over the wall. And then he's like, patient trying to get in. Or somebody's trying to get in. And they'd be like, no, get over the wall. And they just switch him over.
I'm going to start my Halloween with that. That's going to be what I start this year.
That's
now that I see.
And also Gina Davis.
Yeah. I remember a character named Odette. And I always loved her costume.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's just a funny character. That's the thing that you can't understand. This is Netflix is not the same. We talk about it all the time, but like just sitting here right now, as I look at Rob or Becca, I'm just looking at all these covers and I'm curious
what they are. He's not really looking at us. He's looking through us.
And then above them is Transylvania 65,000. So I'm sitting here feeling nostalgic. I feel like a method actor who suddenly hits a sense memory and I'm suddenly being overwhelmed with emotion going, I remember being 12 or something. And it's kind of magic, you know? I definitely think you guys have to come down here. Anyone who lives in LA, but even if you just happen to have time to travel or something, it might be worth it, because it's really just something. Especially for the kind of people, you know, you guys who listen to this and know the kind of movies we all love. This is pretty special.
There's multiple copies of The Boarding House. I mean, where else are you going to find that?
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, we have multiple copies because there are two different versions of the artwork.
Oh, and there's Big Box.
Yeah, the big box,
and then there's the Paragon release. Yeah.
But just know that we're going to buy the things we want to buy before you can, because we're sitting here right now, y'all. There's got to be some perks to being podcasting now, for 4 years.
Yeah. Well, if you're in Los Angeles, definitely come down to the Mystic Museum and check out Slashback Video. Huge thanks to Sebastian for coming down on the show this week. And
if you're on the West
Side, you have to go to Cinephile. You have to check out Touch Vinyl as well. But in particular, Cinephile is where I got my Carpenter shirt,
the
Carpenters looking like they live people. Yeah. So thank you so much for coming down, Sebastian. Yeah,
thanks for having me, guys. Yep. It was an education. I can't wait to download this podcast and see what we've got.
For a rare thing, he's offering a special deal. If you go there and you say Shockwaves, he'll give you 1/4 off the price of a monthly membership.
He's making up bullshit.
1/4.
Elric is talking total bullshit.
That works. See, it's genius. Yeah. It's really nothing.
It's called marketing.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice work.
So yeah, definitely come down and check out Cinephile. It's one of the great modern video stores that is still out there.
Yep.
So.
And there's a record store.
And his record store right
there.
Which one
are you at most physically, personally?
I spend a bit more time at Touch Vinyl just because it still needs the loving care.
Yeah. It's your baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Excellent.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And next week will be our George Romero tribute.
Yep.
So see you then. Great.